Avalon Elections Committee to order. We do not have a quorum yet, so we will hold off on the minutes, but since our first author is here, we thought it only appropriate that we might as well go ahead and get started and bring in the testimony. So, Representative Smith, we can't move your bill yet, but if you would like to explain it to us, that would be wonderful.
Mr. Chairman, I will. I have two witnesses today, but just to summarize what we're here for, Mr. Chairman, House File 2656 provides for litigants to appeal decisions by family court referees directly to the Minnesota Court of Appeals, and this would be in the 4th District, Hennepin County. Litigants already have this option in the Ramsey County Family Court. The Court of Appeals has no problems with this bill. The purpose, Mr. Chairman, is to assist litigants by decreasing the cost, the length, and hopefully the acrimony of family cases handled by referees. Also, to extricate children as soon as possible from custody battles, and finally, to reallocate judicial resources to other pressing areas. The list of supporters is lengthy, but briefly, they include the Hennepin County District Court, the Minnesota Judicial Council, which, Mr. Chairman, is the governing body of the Minnesota Judicial Branch, the American Academy of Matrimonial Lawyers, Minnesota Chapter, the Hennepin County Bar Association Family Law Section, the Minnesota Association for Court Management, and with that, Mr. Chairman, I'd ask the Honorable James T. Swenson, presiding judge, Hennepin County Family Court, to further address the committee.
Thank you, Representative Smith. And, Judge, before you speak, we do have a quorum now, so I would like to take care of the minutes, and then we'll move the bill. Representative Emmer moves approval of the minutes of March 8, 2006. Any discussion? Seeing none, all those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion fails. Minutes are approved. And then, Representative Smith, I will move House File 2656 to be recommended to pass and sent to the General Register.
Thank you.
Judge Swenson, if you could introduce yourself for the record, please, and give us your testimony.
Good afternoon, Mr. Speaker, members of the committee. I'm James T. Swenson, and I'm the presiding judge in the 4th Judicial District Family Court. A couple years ago, some members of the American Academy of Matrimonial Lawyers and other family bar members came to see me. They'd had the experience with the Ramsey County system where there's a direct appeal from referee orders to the Court of Appeals and asked, why can't we have this in Hennepin County as well? It was saving litigants time and money in Ramsey County, and from the bench's perspective, we're always interested in anything that will get children out of the middle of family court litigation as quickly as possible, and we're always interested in saving our litigants money if we can. So we said we would support this bill, and that's why I'm here today. It's worked well in Ramsey County, as I understand it, hasn't precipitated any increase in appeals to the Court of Appeals. It just eliminates a middle step. In Hennepin County, if somebody gets a decision from a referee and they don't like it, they can make a motion in front of the referee to amend it. At the same time, they can make a notice of review to a district court judge to have the district court judge take a look at it. So the person who might have prevailed has to defend it on two fronts. It just costs a lot more money, and it definitely adds delays. So I'm here on behalf of not just Hennepin County, but I'm speaking on behalf of the Judicial Council. We think this would be a very good idea for our constituents.
Thank you, Mr. Swenson. Any questions by members?
Yes.
Representative Hilty.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Smith, Judge, why is this specific to the 4th Judicial District?
Because statutorily there is a 484 creates the family court in Hennepin County, and then there's another statute that creates the family court in Ramsey County, and then there's a third statute that just creates the opportunity for referees throughout the state, although no other districts use them other than St. Louis County has one person they call a hearing officer. The reason why this is peculiar to Hennepin is it only involves the statutorily created 4th Judicial District Family Court.
Thank you.
Other questions or discussion? Representative Westrum.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Either to Representative Smith or Judge Swenson, the current process is, what's the current process? And my second question is, does this limit any more factual evidence at trial? Is the record and all the facts established from the referee, or do they get a new crack at facts and record testimony when they go to a court of appeals?
Okay.
Yes, the way it works right now, statutorily, as the presiding judge, I have the discretion to assign matters to referees to hear and report. That's the statutory language. And they hear all the testimony. They make all of the findings. In the current system, if somebody does not like the referee's decision and they want a notice of review, which is another name for an appeal, it would be looked at by a trial court judge who would not take additional testimony. The trial court judge would be doing the same review of the record that the Court of Appeals would be doing. So under the current situation, you basically have two whacks at the apple. If you didn't like the decision, we're trying to eliminate one.
So, Mr. Chair,
Representative Westrum.
Judge Swenson, so essentially the district court judge is taken out of it here, but you're saying there's no new facts once the litigants have presented their case at the referee level. If something was omitted, it's too late. The Court of Appeals won't consider that either. I mean, and it's currently not considered by the district court judge either. Am I clear on that?
Notice of review process does not involve any additional fact-finding. The judge who does the notice of review has the discretion to remand the matter back to the referee to take additional testimony and deal with an issue, much like the Court of Appeals has the ability to remand. But normally, there isn't an additional level of testimony by the district court judge.
Representative Westrum?
So this is just essentially eliminating the process of the district court judge, because ultimately they're probably going to have a notice of review or an appeal up to the Court of Appeals anyways.
It would go straight to the Court of Appeals. The district court judge stays involved by statute. A decision by a referee does not become an order of the court until it's signed by a judge. And in Hennepin County, we assign one referee to a judge who's a family court judge who gets to know that referee's work product, and that's the person who reviews the referee's decision and signs off. I might add that from time to time when I review a referee's decision that's been sent to me for co-signing, if I don't like it, I will send it back for additional information, or I'll ask the referee questions to help me better understand what they did. So the judges will stay involved, but it'll be at their initiative rather than equivalent of an appeal.
Sure. Thanks.
Other questions or discussion? All right. Mr. Ditburner, did you also want to share some comments? If you could introduce yourself for the record, please, and give us your thoughts.
Good afternoon. My name is Michael D. Ditburner. I'm an attorney who practices in Hennepin County. I'm also the chair of the legislative committee of the Minnesota chapter of the American Academy of Matrimonial Lawyers. We've supported this bill because we believe that the process of appealing referees' decisions to a district court judge is an unnecessary and often wasteful type of step when the issue of seeking correction of a referee's order is best handled by bringing a motion for amended findings to that particular referee, or by appealing directly to the Minnesota Court of Appeals in those occasions in which it's an appealable order. These reviews of referee's decisions by district court judges are done on paper. They don't involve a hearing before that district court judge anyway. And by and large, I would say perhaps in 90% of the cases I've been involved in, over 90%, the decision by the referee has just been affirmed by the district court judge anyway. And for that reason, it becomes an unnecessary step and an expensive step for your client if you are on the receiving end of somebody else's notice of review, because it's going to be affirmed anyway by that district court judge. It's much more efficacious to ask that referee to change their decision and to point out the errors that you believe that there are present in that decision. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Didburner. Any questions or discussion? Anything else, Representative Smith? All right, seeing no further discussion, I will renew my motion that House File 2656 be recommended to pass and placed on the General Register. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion prevails. Thank you, gentlemen.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
All right, the other bill on our agenda for today is House File 2576, Representative Knobloch's bill. We have quite a few testifiers, I believe, on both sides of this issue. Looks like we have 16. My goal is to vote on this at 2:10. We have to be out here by 2:15. If it turns out that we cannot do that, we'll be coming back tonight. But I'm hopeful that we can do that. And what I'd like to do is limit the testimony of our numerous witnesses here. And I think 3 minutes apiece probably will allow us to get through all the testimony by that time. Welcome to the committee, Representative Knobloch. I will move House File 2576 be recommended to pass and placed on the General Register. Representative Knobloch.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chairman and members. Glad to see everyone was able to make it here through all the snow. I was wondering if we'd even have a quorum today, but see that everyone has made it and being responsible. Members, House File 2576 is a simple bill dealing with law enforcement. It outlaws certain provisions of what are commonly known as sanctuary city ordinances. These ordinances, which have been adopted by a few Minnesota cities, including Minneapolis and St. Paul, forbid city employees, including police officers, from asking about someone's immigration status or sharing information with federal authorities about illegal immigration. I'm going to have a delete-all amendment that members should have, the DE-1-2 amendment. But basically what the bill does with the delete-all amendment is it says that cities can't have sanctuary city ordinances like this that, in my view, contravene federal law or prohibit anyone from asking someone their immigration status. And also they cannot, with the amendment, as a matter of policy, just simply adopt the ordinance that these cities have while leaving some discretion for police chiefs to still have an ability to regulate the conduct of their officers. Mr. Chairman and members, the reason I bring this bill forward are three reasons. First, I believe the current ordinances violate federal law. Secondly, I don't think we should be taking discretion away from law enforcement as these ordinances do. And thirdly, I believe that sanctuary ordinances do have the potential to compromise national security. And you should have a handout, members, that starts with the St. Paul ordinance. But I think what I'll do, Mr. Chairman, is go through the rest of my presentation on that, and then we'll do the delete all amendment, if that's okay with
that's
you.
Fine.
Okay. Well, first, if you look at the St. Paul ordinance, and in particular the part that's highlighted, you'll see where it says about two-thirds of the way down under line 2, the fifth line, or at least rather section 44.02, sub A, sub 2, fifth line, it says that information about immigration status in the possession of or known to city employees and representatives, however received, shall not be maintained or recorded except as otherwise specifically required by law. And if you go just a little bit further back in that packet, you'll see a copy of the Federal Immigration Reform Act. And you, if you look at section 642, you can see this would be on the 1, 2, 3, 4, 5th page. If you go down about a third of the page, you'll see item number 2, maintaining such information. And basically, if you start at the top of B, it says, notwithstanding any other provision of federal, state, or local law, no person or agency may prohibit or restrict in any way a federal, state, or local government entity from, among other things, maintaining such information. And here we've got a St. Paul ordinance that at least appears to me to be directly in conflict with this federal law. I think you should also have a federal appeals court case. This whole area has actually been litigated at the federal level. If you look at page 8 of the federal appeals court, New York versus the United States, you'll see again it clearly shows that these sorts of things have been litigated at the federal level, and at least the second appeals court sustain the federal government on an issue like that. So I would say, firstly, I think that we should be passing my bill because the current ordinances we have in place in this state violate federal law. Secondly, I would say we should not be taking discretion away from law enforcement. And members, I would say that law enforcement should have the tools to use whatever legal means are available to remove criminals from our society. If they apprehend the criminal, find out he's an illegal immigrant, they should have the ability to use that information, if they can, use it for the public good. This bill, and I want to make this very, very clear, this bill does not require law enforcement to ask someone their immigration status, doesn't require law enforcement to turn someone who was an illegal immigrant that they find over to the federal authorities. It merely gives them the ability to do so. It says cities cannot prohibit them from doing that. The local police still have the discretion to use their own judgment as to how to use this tool that is available. And finally, members, I talked about the whole national security issue. And last time we had Mark Tangemi, who is the head of the Customs and Immigration Enforcement Service for this five-state area, testify about how he has seen the number of referrals and information coming from Minneapolis and St. Paul to the federal government in areas like this decline since the passage of these ordinances. You know, there's been a lot of debate over the last 4 years regarding the lack of information sharing between law enforcement agencies in the United States. And just as the FBI and the CIA have begun to work together, I think that local, state, and federal branches and levels of law enforcement should work together, too. And local law enforcement does play an important role in fighting domestic terrorism. If you look back to the whole 9/11 plot, three of the 9/11 hijackers, including the alleged ringleader, Mohammed Atta, were stopped by state and local police before the attacks. Two of the three, including Atta, were visa violators. Here in Minnesota, Zacharias Massawi, the alleged 20th 9/11 hijacker, was originally held on an immigration charge. And so, members, I think these examples demonstrate that there is a role for local law enforcement in helping our national security, and they need to have this particular tool to enable them to work on this task. Members, with that, I'd like to go to the Leal Amendment, and then I have a couple of witnesses.
All right.
I'd appreciate if someone would move the DE1-2 Leal Amendment.
I will do that, Representative Nalak. I will move the H2576 DE1-2 Amendment to put the bill into the form that the author would like. Any discussion? Seeing none, all those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion fails. The amendment is adopted.
And to this amendment, just as one other further bit of explanation, Mr. Chair, I do want to make it clear that this amendment says that you can't just adopt by policy the ordinance that we are about to repeal if this bill becomes law. Police chief in Minneapolis can't just say, well, you took away our ordinance, I'm just going to issue a policy directive that we're going to do everything the same way we always did it. But at the same time, I don't want to take away every bit of discretion they have, because I understand they have to run their departments. And so that's why if you look down to the bottom of page one of the amendment, you see the phrase unconditionally restrict, and me basically giving some leeway to police chiefs to manage their department on this issue. With that, Mr. Chairman, or Madam Chairman, now I'd like to have my two witnesses. The first is Commissioner of Public Safety Mike Campion to testify for the bill.
Mr. Campion.
Madam Chair, members, good afternoon. Michael Campion is my name. I'm the Commissioner of Public Safety, and I'm here to support Representative Knobloch's bill. A couple of comments very quickly. Department of Public Safety has had a long tradition, continues to have a very strong emphasis on relationships with local stakeholders. We've had a terrific relationship with Minneapolis and St. Paul Police Department. I greatly respect their police chiefs. They're wonderful departments. We work with them on many other issues, many other fronts. Anything that I may say, I certainly hope is not interpreted as something negative about the police department or the two gentlemen that run their departments. I and the Department of Public Safety have a great deal of respect for them. Community policing probably is the most important concept or important influence on law enforcement in the last 20 years. I do not think that community policing has made law enforcement better. It's made better cops. It's provided for safer communities. I do not think in the end that the prohibition of sanctuary laws will have any real serious effect, if any at all, on community policing. With that, I would like to say that this legislation, you certainly know what it intends to do. I would suggest strongly that it is about one issue and one issue only, and that is prohibiting local units of government from interfering with local police officers when they inquire about a person's immigration status. It doesn't compel police officers to ask about the immigration status. It just simply allows them the opportunity to do so, or does not inhibit them when, in fact, they think that's appropriate. There are thousands of laws in this country that are criminal violations of many different activities. I would like to point out that this is the only law that I am aware of that has been usurped by city ordinances, and that is these immigration, inquiring about the immigration status. I would have two questions. Why this law instead of the other hundreds and literally hundreds of other laws that exist in this country, why is this immigration law, or immigration, the inquiring of a person's immigration status, specifically prohibited? And then I would also ask that why these two cities? We have some 400 plus police departments in Minnesota, and St. Paul and Minneapolis are the only two cities that have an ordinance prohibiting their officers from inquiring about the immigration status in the normal course of police business. I would suggest to you that many other cities in the state, Wilmer and St. Cloud and Worthington, Rochester, any number of other cities in Minnesota do not have sanctuary laws, and they have a very robust immigration and a very robust legal and illegal immigrant population. And I would suggest very strongly to you that those lack of those ordinances do not make those cities any less hospitable to legal or illegal immigrants than the Minneapolis and St. Paul. The ultimate question that should really be asked, are sanctuary laws good public policy? I would suggest, based on those two observations, that they're not. And this legislation simply prohibits cities from prohibiting their officers from inquiring about immigration status. Thank you.
Thank you, Commissioner Campion.
Madam Chair, my second witness would be John Bolduc, the Chief of Police of the City of Brainerd. Okay.
Thank you. Mr. Bolduc.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members. John Bolduc, Police Chief, City of Brainerd. I would like to echo the Commissioner's sentiments regarding the cities of Minneapolis and St. Paul. I, too, have a great deal of respect for the men and women in those departments, and any comments that I make are no reflection or are meant to detract from that respect. A great deal of debate on this issue has occurred in the last few years with respect to the relationship building between local law enforcement and immigrant communities. Good police work dictates that good law enforcement officers have always and will always build positive and meaningful relationships with their immigrant communities. As the Commissioner pointed out, there are many cities in the state that have no such ordinances, that have built excellent working relationships between police and their immigrant communities. In fact, we've been building these relationships in this country for two centuries with immigrants, both legal and illegal. That will continue should the sanctuary city ordinance go away. There are distinct advantages to officers on the street and investigators on the front line knowing information about the people with whom they're dealing, whether it be warrant checks, driver's license status, or immigration status. There are times when the people that we're dealing with, it's helpful for us to know their status, and it's helpful for them to know that we know. There are times where that can be used as leverage against suspects. It can be used to encourage witnesses to cooperate. And it can ultimately lead to the detention of somebody who's involved in a more serious crime. When dealing with community members that have frequent contact with the police, the status of those members change. Today's witness may be tomorrow's suspect or the next day's victim. If the investigator knows someone's immigration status as a victim or a witness, it may have no bearing on the case. In fact, most likely it would not. But if they're a suspect in a more serious crime, knowing their status is a very important piece of information. The two words that I like to attribute to this whole issue our discretion and judgment. We want to have the officers on the street using their discretion. We are still not, and I doubt that we will ever become a show-me-your-papers state or country. That's not the intent. The intent is to apply the federal laws equally. There are many federal laws that local law enforcement has to, when they come upon it, enforce. And we shouldn't be cherry-picking which ones we're going to pick and which ones we're not going to. I thank you.
Thank you, Chief Bolduc. Next, we're going to hear from the other side.
Yep.
And we have Bruce Nestor. See here, Bruce Nestor. Okay. Cheryl Thomas. Cheryl Thomas, then Maria Savola. Okay. Is Maria Savola here? Or Loan Hunya?
You are appointing
Fisher Chair. We're going through these pretty fast. Let's see if we can find somebody that's here. How about Francisco Segovia? Okay. After Francisco is Luis Bertolome.
Hello.
Thank you. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you. What is my time? 3 minutes? Or?
3 minutes.
Okay.
Yes, if you can hold it to that, we appreciate it.
Okay.
Good afternoon, everyone. I'm Francisco Segovia. I manage a community center in Minneapolis, Phillips neighborhood. I came to the United States in 1990, left my country, El Salvador, due to the Civil War. I was forced to come to the United States without documents, so I had to cross the border without papers. And came to Miami first and stayed in Miami for 6 months. And then a friend asked me if I wanted to move to Minnesota. Well, you didn't know about the weather in Minnesota, so I ended up being here, which is a beautiful place. A few years later, through getting some help from local lawyers, I was able to get my residency, and then about 4 years ago, I became a citizen of the United States. So I'm here as a citizen of the United States talking to you right now. 16 years ago, I would be an illegal person, as is the term that constantly used against us. What I want to tell you is that when I came from a country that we fear government. We fear police. So living in Minneapolis about 16 years ago, I saw very often police officers, and I was so afraid to get close to them because I was afraid that they were just do something. And that's fear. And we build that fear, and with these new laws that have been passed, that doesn't do anything that bring more fear to us. In my line of work, we help community members regardless of who they are. We help many, many different ethnicities, Caucasians, African Americans, and so on. But we also have people that don't have documents. They come to us for help for food and other services. And we also, among the services that we provide to them, we help them to file their taxes. You know, through the IRS, we can provide the IT number to people so they can declare their taxes. Through this line of work, we also refer people for other needs. Can be housing, can be health care, etc. We also have a pretty good relationship with the police department, and where we collaborate with them in anything that is needed. I believe that what we do and how we do things right now helps all community members and helped me back in those times when I was here without documents, and that now I am a citizen. And through this time, I have contributed to this society like everybody else. I am here today just to share with you my personal experience, because I believe that it's important that each one of you know that we come to the United States for many different reasons. And when we come here, we want to do good things. There are a few people in any group, a few people who choose to do the wrong things. Just make sure that we are not punishing those who come and contribute to this society. There are a lot of workers without documents who are contributing to this society in a way that every one of you is aware. By passing this bill, the HF 2576, what I think is going to generate that a lot of people who moved 16 years ago will be afraid to go to any government institution to ask for help if they need it, even though if they was working or if they was paying taxes. I want to urge you to think about this. I don't think it's going to solve the problems that we have in the city. It's going to create fear, and fear doesn't help anything.
Okay, Mr. Segovia, your time's just about up.
Okay. I just want to thank you, every one of you. I live in a beautiful city, in a beautiful state, with people who are thoughtful, and they care about this state, and I know that you are visionaries, and this is not visionary. This is against the future. Thank you.
Okay, thank you. Next, we have Luis Bartolome, or Antial Compassino, would be next. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, and I need to take my jacket hooked up on my button. Please, thank you very much. It's way too early for me to testify. I put way too many quarters in my meter, so I was hoping to be heard later, but that's fine. I was characterized as being in opposition to the bill to...
If you could identify yourself for the tape.
I apologize. My name is Luis Bartolome. I'm the interim director of the Chicano Latino Affairs Council, the State Council on the Affairs of Chicano Latino Persons. The council's position is that of neutrality to the bill. And it's very difficult to stand before you and claim to represent the viewpoint of the Latino community. As you can imagine, within our community, there's a very wide range of opinions about subjects such as this. Now, I did not have an opportunity until just a few moments ago to examine this amendment. The last time I testified was before the local government committee, and I actually submitted language proposing essentially that the police chiefs be expressly given the authority to make that decision within their own departments, because their communities change. I mean, Minneapolis and St. Paul, the needs of Minneapolis and St. Paul may be different than the needs of the chiefs in Brainerd, etc. I see this amendment as a bit of an erosion of that, if perhaps I'm misunderstanding some of the language. So I see this as perhaps more restrictive, but quite frankly, I don't think it makes a great deal of difference. And the reason for that is because the... basically, the language that has been proposed here as this bill already exists in federal law. The Illegal Immigration Reform and Illegal Responsibility Act of 1996 already has essentially this language in place. But I've handed out to you an exhibit entitled Relevant Provisions of the IRIRA of 1996, the Illegal Immigration Reform and Immigrant Responsibility Act. I hope you have it before you. And take a look at Section 642. It essentially has the same language of the bill. The issue is already basically addressed. Furthermore, if there is, and we acknowledge and understand that this bill does not impose a requirement of reporting to local law enforcement. We understand that. Should local law enforcement want to get into the business of immigration enforcement, that same act actually provided information on how to basically sign up to become a deputized agent of the ICE, which is contained in Section 133 of the same act. So to sum up, ladies and gentlemen, while we take a neutral position on the bill, we're not certain. We leave it with the question, what will the bill accomplish if passed, if it's already the law of the land, essentially by preemption? Okay. I welcome any questions.
Thank you. I think we're waiting to do questions at the end. Is that... Okay.
Madam
okay.
Chair, can I make one quick response to the point that you made, sir? Part of this is the same as federal law, but if you look particularly at line 20 forward, that is not.
I completely agree. That is not. This is not. I didn't mean to imply, Madam Chair, Senator, Representative Knobloch, that this is verbatim.
Oh yeah, and I understand that you just may have seen it, and so I'm not trying to be accusatory either. I guess I just wanted to make it clear that there was some difference. And in response to your earlier concern, in the last hearing, we were really only dealing with the ordinance and resolution, and this amendment basically would prevent a police chief from just implementing by policy what the ordinance had said, while still giving him some level of discretion. And that's the way I wrote it, the way I did.
Mr. Segovia, if you can go through the chair and Representative Navarro. Okay. Thank you.
May I respond to, yes. to the comments? Madam Chair, Representative Navarro. But I can see the language as being more restrictive than what would otherwise have been there had this language been absent. In other words, I stood before the local government committee and I discussed, we welcome the opportunity to allow local law enforcement to assess the needs of their own local communities and to act accordingly. This restricts the capacity of the chiefs somewhat, does it not?
Representative Knobloch?
Oh, Madam Chair, it restricts it a bit more than the previous bill, because the previous bill only dealt with an ordinance or resolution passed by the city council. And the concern I heard from some people afterwards was that, well, any police chief that wanted to could just automatically implement exactly what the ordinance had said, and there'd be no difference whatsoever if this law passed. And so I felt that we needed to do something more so that we didn't get into a situation where this was, again, the one law that people said, well, we're just not going to enforce, while at the same time leaving some level of discretion to the local police chief in the city. And so that's what this bill does.
Okay. Thank you. Members, yes, because of the weather and so forth, we are down a number of testifiers, so we are going to take a few questions. Were there some questions? Representative Lesh?
My question was more for the author, Chair. Are we doing that now or just for the testifier?
Okay, I think we're going to wait for that till the end.
Fine, okay.
For this, Representative Simon, for this testifier.
Thank you, Mr. Segovia. I have a question about the...
That's Bartolome for the record.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Different testifier. The one previous to me was...
Oh, I'm sorry. I was just looking at my notes. I apologize, Mr. Bartolome. On the federal law, as I read it, I don't know if you have the handout in front of
you.
It lists three things, essentially, that may not be restricted. Am I reading that correctly? In Section 642, sub B, and then there's 1, 2, and 3.
Madam Chair, Representative Simon, I see the three that you're pointing out, yes.
And I'm looking at the new version of the bill here, the Delete All Amendment. And the one thing that this new amendment has that federal law doesn't is... as I'm reading it anyway, simply inquiring about immigration status. Am I reading it correctly or incorrectly to say that the one thing that this federal law does not preclude is a city saying that law enforcement may not inquire about?
I see what you're saying, and I would tend to agree with you that this bill is more the bill before this body is more specific in that way.
Mr. Bartolome, if you can remember to go through the chair.
Forgive me, Madam Chair. Madam Chair, Representative Simon, what I would say that arguably, if you read Section 642, it perhaps can be construed as being more restrictive than the local bill that's being proposed. So that leaves this body, Madam Chair, Representative Simon, the question. Does it not, federal law, doesn't it preempt by subject, through the Constitution, doesn't it preempt the subject altogether? And shouldn't then the law of the land be the federal provision, which is actually more restrictive? I mean, this is ominous to me and to the council, because it goes further than the bill that's proposed. But this is inevitable. This is unavoidable. This is a law as I understand it. There may be disagreements as to interpretation. There may also be case law that should have to be followed up on this stuff. And I'm not a constitutional scholar or legal scholar, but I do want to bring this to your attention. So I agree with your point that it is that this specifically the bill addresses the solicitation and or disclosure of status. But when you read Section 642, it seems more broad.
Which seems, Madam Chair?
Representative Simon?
Which one are you saying seems more broad?
Excuse me, more restrictive, Section 642, Madam Chair, Representative Simon.
So, Madam Chair?
Representative Simon?
If I understand your read, and I know that you may have just seen or compared the two sets of language here, but if I understand your read, you agree then that the federal law currently does not restrict or prohibit a city from passing an ordinance that would preclude an officer from asking. Do you understand the question?
I think I do, but I think the bill, excuse me, Madam Chair, Representative Simon, I understand the question, but I think Section 642 does prohibit that. It is specifically aimed at, if I understand it correctly, keeping local authorities and federal authorities, local government entities or officials from enacting these so-called sanctuary laws. So, I mean, the subject is spoken for is what I'm saying. And to the concern that, you know, we may have an erosion of community policing, et cetera, because we're going to deputize our local law enforcement officers to carry out the duties that should be ascribed only to the ICE, well, Section 133 provides a process by which local law enforcement can engage in that process, very specific. In fact, I think Florida has a pilot program currently that's using Section 133 of the Act to carry out these obligations. I mean, it even shifts the tort liability to the federal government should there be a commission of a tort by a local law enforcement officer in the carrying out of these duties. So it's very specifically spoken for is what I'm saying. And I want to leave this body with that notion.
Representative Simon.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just want to make sure I'm understanding your interpretation because you hold a position that I think is very important, and a lot of people will look to your interpretation or your guidance on this, I think. I'm looking at 642, and I see a list of three things that the federal law says a city council may not do by ordinance. A city council may not, number one, bar their personnel from sending such information to INS, or I suppose now ICE, or whatever the relevant agency would be. Number two, a city may not pass an ordinance saying, hey, our folks may not maintain such information. And number three, a city may not pass an ordinance saying, hey, our folks may not exchange such information with federal, state, or local government entity. That's the full list that I see. Where do you see something else? Where do you see an item whereby a city now, currently under federal law, may not tell its folks, you may not ask? Do you understand the question?
Mr. Bartolomew?
Madam Chair, Representative Simon, I don't see it there. I'm reading the same language that you are, and it's, I don't see it there. One could interpret the act as covering that conduct, though. And that's why I think further research into the interpretation of this act and following case law perhaps can enlighten us a little bit. But I understand the representative's remarks.
Okay. Thank you. I think we're going to move to the next testifier.
Thank you very much for this opportunity.
Thank you. Is Antial Campesino here for the next testifier?
Madam Chair.
Representative Broad?
Can I just ask Mr. Bartolomew one more question? I'm sorry. I'm just trying to process what Representative Simon was going at there. I'm sorry.
Mr. Bartolomew, we have one more question. Representative Broad?
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I'm sorry, Mr. Bartolomew, thank you very much for sitting back down.
My pleasure.
I'm trying to understand and maybe get a little bit more clarification on your position as well. I think I heard you say to Representative Knobloch that you supported the local chief's right to assess the community needs. But then I thought I heard you say that 642 essentially made that illegal.
Oh, no.
So I'm trying to just get a clarification on whether, one, you believe that it is illegal for them to have these ordinances or not, and two, your position on the local determination of that matter.
Mr. Bartolomew?
Madam Chair, sorry, Representative, is
Broad.
It Broad? When you say that Section 642 makes such ordinances illegal. Now, what I meant to convey to this body, and what I meant to convey at my last hearing, is that the council does not object to the notion that the local chiefs of police can make these decisions, not by ordinance, obviously. Section 642 prohibits the ordinances. The language that I believe the author has added was designed to address that issue specifically, not allowing carte blanche to the chiefs to be able to simply take, cut and paste the current ordinances and make them into the departmental policies. I think that's what the added language does, essentially. But Section 642 prohibits the ordinances, but it doesn't speak to regulating a police chief's own departmental policy.
Okay. Representative Broad.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I guess I just want a clarification that you view the ordinances are in violation of federal law, and should we pass legislation, they would then therefore be in violation of state law.
Mr. Bartolome.
Madam Chair, yes.
Okay. Thank you. The next witness.
Madam Chair, if I can make one point to this, too. Mr. Bartolome. Mr. Bartolome.
Yes, sir.
I guess I would say that if you look at line 12 of the amendment, which is federal law, it talks about not just governmental unit, but local official. And so I would say that police chiefs would fall underneath the definition of local official and so are already restricted by federal law.
Mr. Bartolome?
Assuming that the definition of your bill is the same or consistent with federal law, is that what you're saying?
Well, I guess what I had interpreted you to say that that local police chiefs maybe didn't have discretion on these other issues, the top three, and I guess I'm saying no, the federal government takes away that discretion already.
You're referring, Madam Chair, Representative Navak, referring to Section 642?
Yes. Or it talks about local official as well as a local government unit.
If the definition, Madam Chair, thank you. Sorry. Representative Navlog, if the definitions between your bill and federal law are consistent with each other. Yes.
Okay, thank you. Next we have, if Auntie Al Campesino isn't here, we'll do Kevin Mew, Norman Monroe. Okay, Norman Monroe. After Norman Monroe is Linda Hoon. And then Susie Brown. And then Susan Trammell. Mr. Monroe, welcome to the committee.
Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Mr. Monroe.
Yes, thank you. Chairman Swawick,
yes.
And committee members.
You can identify yourself for the tape.
My name is Norman Monroe. And next to me, I'll go ahead and introduce yourself. Thank you very much, all of you, for this opportunity to speak on the subject of 2576. Which would prevent the establishment of sanctuary zones in Minnesota. Am I coming through loud enough here? I'm a spokesman for MUIR, which stands for Minnesotans United for Immigration Reform. We represent not only groups here in the Twin Cities, but all throughout the entire state that is very much interested in this issue. Every state also has similar immigration reform groups, and we're affiliated with, at the national level, with FAIR, which stands for Federation of Americans for Immigration Reform, and their web address, if you're interested, is FAIRUS, FAIRUS.org. We're opposed, to say the least, to illegal immigration, where anything which aids and abets illegal immigration we are opposed to, as all of you committee members and you, Representative Knobloch, thank you very much for introducing this bill. We appreciate that. This issue of sanctuary zones really is just a very small but a significant part of a much, much larger picture, which is creating, and you should know this, a lot of anger all over this state. And it's also really perpetuating and exacerbating a problem that 10 years or 15 years ago did not exist. 10 years ago, I don't know that there even was. Well, I know that Minneapolis instituted their sanctuary zone about, I think it was 03, and in 04, St. Paul followed suit. For the second time, by the way, as far as I know. We've already been down this trail once before with the sanctuary zone, if you recall your history of St. Paul. About 70 years ago, we had a similar arrangement, sanctuary zone. Different folks, of course, different kind of people involved there. For the unsavory types that we really didn't want in St. Paul, but the police department looked the other way, wink, wink, and a nod, nod. And guess what? We got more of what we didn't want. So these sanctuary zones were a bad idea then, and they're a bad idea now. So the sanctuary zones, as has been pointed out, is to contravene and frustrate the implementation of federal laws. But there's one of the things that we're here today to express is the concerns of the general citizens in this state. That's a constituency that doesn't seem to be, except for ourselves, we have not really been heard from. That is the traditional population of this state. The ones that I mentioned are getting very, very angry over this whole thing. And we see the sanctuary zones as a method or a means of sending the message out that, hey, we welcome illegals. You should also be aware, too, that this is not just a Minnesota issue. I think you probably already are aware of it, but we want to make this very clear that if you had watched the news, for instance, the national news last Friday, you would have seen the chaos, the mayhem at our southern borders. And when we make life very inviting, when we send out the message, sanctuary zones do that, you send out the message, hey, come on north. It may not be as nice and warm and comfy and beautiful, unless you like snow and ice, but come on north. There's a reason why we have the perceived need for this kind of thing here. So, what's happening here is that maybe the police department, I heard them a week before last, Chief McManus talk about creating trust. Well, you're eroding trust.
You can wrap up, Mr. Monroe.
Okay. You're eroding trust within the traditional community. So we urge you to pass 2576. Not just because of the legalistic arguments that you've been hearing, but also because of the message that it sends that we aren't going to tolerate illegals here in this state.
Thank you. Are you Linda Hoon?
Yes.
You can welcome to the committee.
Okay, yes. My name is Linda Hoon, and I hope you'll forgive me if I'm somewhat unprepared. I'm coming on this issue somewhat from the end. I am not a paid lobbyist. I'm not here representing any group, although I do support an organization that believes that we need to reform our immigration policies in this country. I am a native-born Minnesotan. I have lived here all my life except when I traveled abroad and once I worked in another state. Now, I agree with everything Mr. Monroe said, and I only just met him this morning. Apparently, we agree on this issue. But I agree with everything he said, but I would like to also expand on the larger issue here, which is, it seems to me that people who come here from other countries and paid lobbyists and so on are trying to chip away at our immigration policy. And I think a lot of it is through guilt. You know, we always say we're the richest country in the world and we're the strongest country in the world and we have the Statue of Liberty and everything. And somehow, if we don't take every immigrant or every illegal immigrant who wants to come here, it's like they're betraying the Statue of Liberty. Well, I would submit that the citizens of a country, a state, a municipality, have the right to say who comes into their areas if they are illegals. We have a right to not only control the U.S. border, but we have an obligation to comply with federal law, and we have a right to enforce our laws. We should not feel guilty about that. And I'd like to say, in Minnesota, we're very nice people. We do not want children to go to bed hungry. We don't want anybody to live in economic poverty. But you know what? We went through the Civil War in this country. We went through the Revolutionary War and many other types of strife to make sure we are one country, one people, one language. And that doesn't mean we can't have diversity. But what we do need in this country is a sense of unity. And it starts with laws being enforced. Now, I said a minute ago that no Minnesotans believe anyone should live in fear and poverty. Along with this is we have to understand human nature. Human nature takes the path of least resistance. If people are told, and if it is their custom in their community, in their country, that they don't solve their problems where they're at, and they don't take care of their own communities because somebody will help them somewhere else, they will do it. They will go there because they're desperate. And I want to tell you, I love other countries, I love other cultures, but it is time for some tough love here. And love is tough. And it is time for the United States, perhaps in other ways, to help other people achieve their economic goals. But this does not start with bringing everyone into this country who wants to come here, because if we do, we're going to have a super overpopulation problem. I'm going to wind up here. Yes. The other thing is that immigration, especially illegal immigration, costs people money. Nowadays, we have a huge federal debt. We're going to have thousands of veterans coming because of this war. We need to educate our children, and we need to have a health care policy. People who come here illegally can still avail themselves of our services, and I don't think the hardworking people of Minnesota need to pay for this. I'm sorry. Thank you very much.
Okay, thank you. Next, we have Susie Brown, and then Karen Wagner, and then John Choi. Susie Brown, welcome to the committee.
Good afternoon. Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. My name is Susie Brown. I'm the Public Policy Director for Family and Children's Service in Minneapolis, and I'm here today to testify on behalf of AFFIRM. AFFIRM is the Alliance for Fair Immigration Reform, an alliance of more than 25 immigrant groups, religious and labor organizations, legal services, and human service organizations. We are working together to advocate for comprehensive immigration reform legislation that will address the brokenness of the current immigration system. AFFIRM affirms the rights of immigrants who are working in the United States to obtain legal status, to reunite with their families, and to create a system of immigration that respects both human and labor rights. We affirm the rights of immigrants and honor the contribution they have made to this country and to the state of Minnesota. Our state was built by Native peoples and immigrants, and we can't forget the history of how Minnesota was developed. In the interest of public safety, we do not believe that local police should be used as a tool for immigration enforcement. The administration's proposal to prohibit cities from having sanctuary laws that prevent local law enforcement from inquiring about immigration status or enforcing immigration laws will not make our communities safer. Instead, immigrants, both legal and undocumented, will be driven further into the shadows of our communities. This proposal will undermine the contributions made by community policing. The city councils of St. Paul and Minneapolis passed separation ordinances by overwhelming majorities. The police chiefs of both cities supported the ordinance because they make the community safer and strengthen the relationship between law enforcement and the immigrant community. Shouldn't we respect the views of those we trust to enforce public safety in our local communities? City officials have also told us that they lack the expertise to enforce the complexities of immigration law. Our immigration system is complex with a wide array of immigration statuses and visas. It is difficult enough for a trained immigration official to wade through the system, and there is no way that we should expect the average policeman to understand an individual status during a traffic stop or when reporting a crime. We reject House File 2576. Not only does this bill extend federal immigration enforcement to local law enforcement, but to all employees of the various subdivisions. Particularly in these times when budgets for local governments are already stretched and government workers have far more work than they know what to do with, it seems absurd that we would add one more thing to their job descriptions. Local communities do not need another unfunded mandate, nor do they need the state and federal government to tell them how to deliver local services. We do not believe House File 2576 is the right thing to do or the smart thing to do, not for immigrants and not for our communities. Thank you.
Okay, thank you. Next, we have Karen Wagner, and actually then we have Omar Jamal after that. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. I'm Karen Lowry Wagner with the City of Minneapolis, and I have to apologize. I had a deputy chief and an assistant city attorney, but due to weather conditions and school-related activities, they are not able to make it. I do want to read a brief statement and just give you an overall position from the City of Minneapolis. The role of local law enforcement is first and foremost to protect public safety. Public safety is best served when people with the greatest need are able to trust the police to keep them safe. Without trust in local law enforcement, people are needlessly trapped in dangerous situations. No one is safe when trust erodes between public and law enforcement. And our chief was present at a previous hearing, and I just want to echo some of his comments about building a community of trust with all members of our community. That is the chief. Our local police departments fill one of their most vital roles in the community is to build this trust. That is the reason the ordinance was adopted by the city, and that is why we oppose, with all due respect, Representative Knobloch's bill. We do not feel this will make the community more safe. It will erode the trust between certain members of our committee, and we would respectfully ask that you oppose this legislation.
Can I ask a question?
Thank you. Representative Emmer?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Ma'am, with all due respect to the City of Minneapolis, I'm looking at this decision from the Southern District of New York, which references the Immigration Reform Act that was signed into law on September 30th of 1996. And I've listened to testimony today that the City of Minneapolis passed its sanctuary ordinance in 2003, so almost some 7 years after. Can you tell me what the discussion was when this apparently passed by an overwhelming margin, as you described, by the City of Minneapolis City Council? What was the discussion about violating the Act and some precedent that's out there describing the Supremacy Clause and the 10th Amendment, there was any?
Ms. Wagner?
Madam Chair, Representative, I did not state that it was overwhelmingly. That was someone else's.
Oh,
I just want to clarify that.
My apology.
Same
problem you have.
I'm not a city attorney, so I'm going to try this. We do not believe that the New York City opinion applies to our ordinance because it dealt with what information our ordinance limits, what information is sought, not what information is shared, and that's the distinction that was drawn. I don't have before me minutes from meetings or details about the discussion regarding the adoption of our ordinance, but I think it's fair to say that we would not adopt an ordinance that we thought was in violation of a federal law.
Madam Chair?
Representative?
Just as one follow-up, then, that distinction in your last statement, we, meaning the City of Minneapolis, would not violate a federal law. First, the decision, this Southern District of New York decision, is based on the Constitution, which I think the state of Minnesota is governed under, and I think you'd agree, the City of Minneapolis. And I guess my question was, and I guess I'm asking you to confirm, that there was discussion by the city council in Minneapolis how they could avoid this law legally. Is that right? And maybe that's a little too strong, but you see what I'm getting at? Because I want to know, did the city, when it passed this ordinance, know full well that this decision was out there and how they were going to word it? So, because I've read your ordinance, and it looks a lot like the one that they reference in this case from New York. I just want to know, was there a purposeful intent on the part of City of Minneapolis to avoid the federal law in enacting this ordinance?
Ms. Wagner?
Madam Chair, I'm not able to answer that question.
Okay. Madam Chair,
thank
just
you.
To that point, and, you know, Representative Emmer had some questions about this, not really specifically the City of Minneapolis, but the language of the ordinance. And St. Paul City Attorney is scheduled to speak, but he has indicated he's able to speak to this issue with respect to St. Paul's position, which might be helpful on this point if you wanted to hear it now.
Madam Chair, Representative Lesch, that's fantastic, because I think it was the City of St. Paul ordinance that most closely resembles the one in this case. I might have misspoken.
Okay.
But, Representative Lesch, Representative Emmer, why don't we have one person before John, the city attorney, John Choi, and so if we can have that person, and then he'll be up next. If he's here, Omar Jamal, and he is here.
Thank you, Madam
Chair, and
committee members.
Already.
As I mentioned earlier in my hearing, the last committee,
can you state your name?
My name is Omar Jamal. I'm the director of the Somali Justice Advocacy Group. It's a center that advocates the equal application of the law in the state of Minnesota. And our grave concern about this bill is that, if anything else, it sends one message to the community, which is fear and creating a deep mistrust. And we believe that after 9/11, there's been a very aggressive outreach, both at the federal level and local level, to reach out immigrants, to bring them part of the community and the main community, to make them feel like that we are all in this together of the war on terrorism. And if this bill, if there's any breach of security or any contradiction of law, federal or local, we believe that someone should have acted before, because I think we should not wait this long to bring this issue back on the table. If there was any serious breach of security, I think they ought to have acted way before than now. Therefore, I believe strongly mentioned over again and again that if anything else, this bill creates mistrust and disconnection of a huge part of the segment of immigrant population in both Twin Cities and across the state. And I think it's very vital and it's very important, essential in this package to think what message this bill sends to the people. And if anything else, I would like to ask the author to, if he has ever considered reaching out immigrants and explain to them the impact that this bill has on them or what they think of it, because it looks like if it's in bottom, don't fix it. I think this bill doesn't make it mandatory to the local police officers to ask if they blow over an immigrant their papers. It gives them a discretion, which that the way it's always been. So I don't think so. If it adds anything to the substance of this issue, I think it's still going to be the same. We believe that if that's the case, if this bill passes, I think some officers might misuse that and push it to the extreme. Therefore, they've been doing it. As an immigrant, we know that. There are a lot of people that are in immigration detention right now after they've been committed a crime with felony or gross misdemeanor. So someone, there's a communication already exists between the feds and the local police officers. It's a discretion, and therefore, again, I urge the community members here to really think very careful about this issue, and it simply comes down to one thing, the kind of message that it sends to the immigrant population, to citizens and other places. So with that, I would like to emphasis on that on behalf of the Somali immigrants in Twin Cities. Thank you, Madam Chairman. Thank you,
Mr. Jamal. I see we have a question. Representative Simon?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Sir, thanks for coming today. My question to you is this. What has been your experience or the experience of others with whom you're associated in cities that do not have such ordinances? In other words, where cities right now do not have these separation ordinances, have you or have you not experienced any different kind of conduct?
Mr. Jamal?
Yes, Chair, Madam, and committee members. The differences in the state of Minnesota relies on the the population scattered across this state. Twin Cities is one of the main cities in this state that immigrants are constantly populated. The experiences we have in Twin Cities is that the community feel somehow that they are protected by the constitution of the law of the land. The police has a specific job to do, and there's a separation of function of governments. And with that in mind, I think they operate their routine in lives with a sense of comfort. I'm not in any way or shape or form urging any illegal activities among immigrants. However, it has this concept in mind that he or she feels comfortable that they can pick up the police and report a crime. Whether they are at home, whether they are at work, if this is something suspicious, the difference here is that if an immigrant will feel okay to pick up and call the 911 and inform the law enforcement agents, whenever they are, that what the things they've seen. So if anything else this deal does is that it connects, it cuts that connection. It creates a fear, a chilling fear on immigrants in Twin Cities. Cities like Rochester or Mankato or Owatonna or St. Cloud, where there is some substantive Somali population immigrants there, we mainly focus here, but our concern is that the drop of the report of the crime rates among the immigrants, with which we've been working with the police to improve that, which it will be a huge setback if this bill passed. Because I'll tell you this, everywhere we go, I thought the community weren't even as aware as they are now about this bill, which they know it very well. And if it goes through, our concern is it's going to be a huge setback to what we've been doing after 9/11 to encourage the community, to make them feel like they're part of the community, we're all in this together. Report if you see something suspicious. That is it's not going to happen if this bill goes through. That's our concern. And I think it sounds same with the police chiefs in Twin Cities, that they know that if this goes through, that they will not get the same cooperation that they have with the community as they used to do in the past.
Representative Simon.
Thank you, Madam Chair. You mentioned a few cities in your response there, Owatonna and some others, Mankato. In those cities or in any others that are suburban Twin Cities communities, do you have any examples or anecdotes of what you believe to be a difficult situation for immigrants or not? I ask the question because the communities that I represent have immigrant communities in them, and as I understand the bill, this would make Minneapolis and St. Paul essentially like the communities that I represent. So I'm wondering if you have any information to share with the committee about those non-Minneapolis and St. Paul cities, wherever they may be, that leads you to believe, based on prior or existing experience, that there would be a problem.
Mr. Kamal.
Thanks, Madam Chair and committee members. One of the recent experiences that we had a couple of weeks ago, as you might have already seen on the news, is that there is some Somali man in jail in Moorhead, Minnesota, where they've been caught using cap in Somali threats that the Jew, and it's mostly from East Africa. And when they were arrested, right off the bat, we get a phone call from Moorhead that immigration are involved because it's felony. What we know from that and similar experiences is that somehow there's there's information channel between the local police and the immigration departments. In spite, even not only small towns, but also in the main Twin Cities area. How is that happening? Most often, it's, as we believe it, is the terrorist task forces or the level of the crime that the person commits. It all depends. It's most often a misdemeanor, usually immigration doesn't get involved. So what we know is that there is a following information between these two departments. As far as small towns is concerned, we often hear a complaint from the main cities. The people live in the small towns out of these two main cities. We don't usually have any complaints from them. But in Minneapolis and St. Paul, that's where we focus. You have more than 80% of immigrants of either percent live in Twin Cities.
Somali immigrants, the office, we get phone calls from there. But the small towns, because of the number of people live there, and of even less crime, it's not as much crime rates as in Twin Cities.
Okay, thank you.
We need to focus our survey there.
And Representative Broad?
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Mr. Jamal, thank you very much for being here today. One of the things that you mentioned that intrigued me was that you thought that the separations of the functions were, it was very important to keep that separation. Others would argue that it's extremely important in terms of keeping the separation for the feeling of safety, I guess is what I should say. Others would argue that it's extremely important to have a seamless government system between the levels of government. And that seamlessness, whether it's Hurricane Katrina or whether it's an issue that involves our national security, that seamlessness and that collaboration between the levels of government, whether it's local government or national government, is extremely important in terms of people's feeling of safety and feeling of security. And those two things seem to contradict, and I just wanted to see if you had any comments in that regard.
Mr. Jamal.
Thanks, Madam Chair and committee members. The relevance and importance of that cooperation between branches of governments, I think after 9/11, we view that as equally important as anything else because of the circumstances that the country found itself into this. However, the government, the people that they serve, and the message they send sometimes is equally important. And there are already now in place such cooperation between branches and different departments of governments. However, what we view this bill is that it doesn't add any substance to that process. One thing that it does is it sends the concept of mistrust and fear. Because we believe that something is already there. Because I don't think so. There's any immigrant population in the state of Minnesota that has experienced difficulties after 9/11. Somalis were caught in the middle. And now that we know that there is already some connection between these two branches, whether it's local, federal, or city level. So when this deal comes on the table, I think, if anything else what it does, is it sends a message that if the person feels whenever they report a crime to the police, that the police will take one extra step by inquiring something else. It will stop that process from happening, which has already been happening, and since 9/11, we have never experienced any major problems in the immigrant population in Twin Cities or in Minnesota. So what we feel is that in spite of the existence of that relationship between governments, we don't feel this bill adds anything to those processes or it will help. Rather, we think it creates fear, it creates mistrust, and it's not worth of taking this step. That's what we feel.
Representative Broad? Okay, thank you.
Thank you, Madam.
We're going to go to John Choi next, and also Officer Martinez, or Chief Martinez, or Officer Martinez, if you want to testify together, welcome to the committee. We'll start with Mr. Choi.
Madam Chair and members, my name is John Choi, City Attorney for the City of St. Paul. Obviously, it's a very controversial and emotional issue, and I just want to refocus the debate a little bit because I think and I want to address some of Representative Emmer's issues, and I want to speak specifically about the federal law issue, whether or not the city's ordinance, the City of St. Paul's ordinance, is in violation of that federal law. And then secondly, I would like to talk about an argument that Representative Knobloch in his comments talked about in terms of ensuring that we have local discretion for our local law enforcement officers and to give them the ability to do what they need to do. And that is kind of addressed in that federal New York case. So, you know, the St. Paul ordinance was enacted in 2004. And that was after the New York case, which was the Second Circuit case in 1999. And we drafted that ordinance to be in compliance with the United States Constitution and the applicable federal laws that were in place at the time. So first of all, to distinguish that case, the Second Circuit case is the circuit on the East Coast, but it governs in Minnesota is the Eighth Circuit case. So that's one distinction that I would first like to make before I talk about that particular case. In that case, essentially the city of New York was seeking a declaratory judgment action, and they were actually the ones who were arguing the 10th Amendment and arguing the issues of the United States Supremacy Clause. In that particular case, why we felt that it was not, why in terms of how we drafted the ordinance, we drafted it so that essentially what we were hoping to accomplish by drafting the ordinance was to develop essentially a guideline for our employees. And I think that goes to the local control issue that, or the local authority of police enforcement, and such that if we're talking about local police, and I think the case talks about this, and in fact, it, in the case it says, they acknowledge the right of the local unit of government as an employer to establish certain policies and procedures that should exist. Although they didn't decide the case on this particular issue, they acknowledge that this was a substantial argument, but given the fact of what was on the record, they chose not to address this particular issue. But the issue that I would raise is that as an employer, the city of St. Paul, in terms of governing its local law enforcement police officers and how they exercise their authority, we feel that it is within our right to establish a certain guideline that does not frustrate and go against what is federal law. And we believe that the way that the ordinance was drafted essentially comports to what I just said, and that it would not violate the federal law and the United States Constitution. I'll just quote from the case. It says, whatever the outer limits of state sovereignty may be, it surely encompasses the right to set duties of office for state-created officials and to regulate the internal affairs of government bodies. Police officers are employees. The city council that enacted this ordinance are elected officials, and essentially what I would argue is that the city council was enacting essentially what the electorate wanted, and this is in a lot of ways to reframe this issue. I believe it's a matter of local control and the ability for a local unit of government to have policies that would essentially guide its employees on how to handle immigration matters. And essentially that is what is not discussed and what Representative Knobloch did not bring up as part of that case. Although the case did not focus on that particular point, that was an important point that the court made, that it didn't get to that particular argument that the city raised, because in terms of what the legal issues before it, they were not there. So in essence, what I'm trying to say is that in drafting this ordinance, we drafted it, you know, consistent with that opinion, and to make it so that we were trying to provide guidance as a matter of policy for our local officers. And I think Commander Martinez could speak to some of the security issues.
Colonel Martinez, I see the Eagles mean a colonel.
Well, senior commander, sir.
Senior commander, okay. I am going off the military equivalent. So.
Senior Commander Martinez, correct?
Yes.
You recognize it. Please identify yourself for the record.
I'm Bill Martinez. I'm a senior commander of the St. Paul Police Department, and I'm here on behalf of Chief Harrington. We had a prior commitment. The St. Paul Police Department has been in existence for over 150 years. We are the oldest police department in the state, and we have a national reputation for being professional and progressive. A lot of police departments, not only in the state but in the nation, look to us for best practices in policing. The ordinance that the city adopted was based on a policy that we drafted prior to the adoption in 2003. We know policing, and we know effective and successful community policing. You know, my predecessors, going back 150 years, have bought into the philosophy of community policing. And we feel that immigration enforcement by local law enforcement is a direct blow to our efforts to win trust and confidence of the communities that we serve. There's arguments made that this will help us if we enforce immigration efforts, it will help us in our policing efforts. It's been my experience that witnesses sometimes to crimes sometimes are not here legally and are going to be less reluctant to come forward with information for fear that they're going to be deported. We've had this, like I said, we've had our policy this for several years before the ordinances, and we're one of the safest cities of our size in the country. We know what effective policing is. The other thing that concerns me about this is a racial profiling. If law enforcement begins to look at Minnesotans who look like immigrants, they're going to look like me probably. And if I'm driving through one of the cities, and if I'm, am I going to be stopped driving while brown or driving while black? I can trace my ancestors back on my mom's side 400 years to southern Colorado and northern New Mexico. Now you can make the argument that that was part of Mexico and I'm an immigrant, but I would make a counter argument on that. I guess just to sum up this is we think that it would be detrimental to make our police officers an extension of immigration enforcement, and it would the trust and confidence that we've gained from our citizens that's taken us decades will be eroded overnight. Thank you.
Thank you, Senior Commander Martinez. We'll take a couple questions from committee members. Let everybody know here with us today in the committee, I do intend to take a vote by 10 minutes after 2 on this bill, so I'd appreciate your cooperation. Representative Emmer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. These are for the city attorney, Mr. Choi. Mr. Choi, you started your remarks by saying this is a controversial and emotional issue, and I'll just take the emotion out of it for you. I'll tell you, I got a couple of questions I want to ask you, but I'm going to preface it with, after reading the St. Paul Ordinance and the New York case, you call it distinguishing the analysis. I call it cute lawyering and drafting. As the city attorney, Mr. Choi, do you believe in application of all the laws?
Mr. Choi.
Well, sure, yeah, absolutely.
Okay, and would you...
Representative Emmer.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Choi, would you agree with me that immigration is a federal issue?
Mr. Choi.
Yeah, in a lot of ways it is, yeah, absolutely.
All right, and...
Representative Emmer.
Mr. Chairman, you said that your testimony at the conclusion, you said, we just wanted to provide local employees with a guideline on how to handle immigration matters. Isn't it true that this ordinance, the way it's been drafted by the lawyers, in fact, the ordinance is intended to prohibit state and local government, in this case, local government entities or officials from directly being involved in the voluntary exchange of immigration information. Isn't that true,
Mr. Joy?
It's a very complicated ordinance. I think the ordinance is in your packet. I can kind of run you through it, but I mean, the way that it is drafted, I mean, you call it kind of crafty lawyering. I think it's actually was trying to address some of the federal legal issues that were out there. And I mean, the first section is actually the purpose and policy statement, and I think that is a very important thing to read because I think it's not trying to frustrate the purpose of what the federal law is. And with respect to your issue, it does allow for communications with the federal government, and for instance, with respect to public safety officials, if you go to section 44.03, numbers 4 and 5, it says nothing in this chapter shall prohibit public safety personnel from assisting federal law enforcement officers in investigation of criminal activity involving individuals present in the United States who may also be in violation of federal civil immigration laws. Secondly, it goes on to say nothing in this chapter prohibits public safety personnel from adequately identifying criminal suspects or assessing the risk of flight of criminal suspects. So what we're trying to do is have a policy of cooperation.
That's Mr. Chairman. I should be careful with the questions I asked. I thought it was narrow, Mr. Choi, but I'll narrow it even further. Section 44.03A(1), and I'll paraphrase it.
you've drafted it very craftily so that it restricts your employees' ability to inquire about immigration status. In other words, you have directed your employees that under no circumstances are they to ask if they are dealing with an illegal immigrant, and that information then they could share. And that's the difference, because the New York case, this is crafty lawyering with all due respect to you, sir, because the New York case talks about sharing the information. The way it's been drafted here is it restricts their ability to ask about the information. Isn't that true?
Mr. Choi.
Yes, and if it's the sole purpose of the inquiry, which would be the immigration violation, that is what is prohibited by public safety officials.
Thanks. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. Representative Broad.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Thank you, Mr. Choi, for your testimony. I too, when you opened, you said this is an emotional issue, and I agree with you that it is an emotional issue for a lot of people. One question I would have for you, however, is does the city of St. Paul have a position or a formal position as to whether this law passes? When you talk about an emotional issue, when Representative Knobloch came out with his bill, I think I read it in the newspaper that Mayor Coleman responded saying that it doesn't essentially matter, and I'm paraphrasing, I can go up to my office and get the piece of paper if you'd like it, but it really doesn't matter what the state does in this regard because we won't abide by it. We won't abide by the law should it should pass. And I'm just wondering if that's a position that your city has or if that's just Mayor Coleman being responding emotionally to the bill. I've really appreciated us sitting here talking about the merits or the lack thereof today as opposed to those emotional arguments, and I just wanted to know if that was an official position.
Mr. Choi.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Broad, I guess I don't know exactly. I haven't read what the mayor had said, and he and I have not had a direct conversation about that, but maybe it wasn't an emotional statement. Is that Ms. Frias is the Director of External Affairs. I don't know exactly.
Thank you. Please. Mr. Chair, is that okay?
Certainly. It'd be fine. Ma'am, if you'd identify yourself for the record, please. And the question is, was Mayor Coleman's pronouncement an official position of the city?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Luz Maria Frias. I'm the Director of External Affairs for the Mayor in St. Paul. I don't recall reading that statement, and if you can provide to me what the source of that statement is, I can assure you that the Mayor, as leader of St. Paul and also as an attorney, would be one to be follow any law that would be passed by the legislature.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Broad.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you very much. I do appreciate you saying that, and I will provide that to you. It's up in my office. And then secondarily from that, if this law is passed, I would assume then, just hearing your response, that the city of St. Paul would abide by the law in the state of Minnesota.
If this legislation passed as amended, there would be parts of this ordinance that would be in conflict with the state law.
Representative Broad.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Mr. Choi, then, one separate question. Have you been able to glean anything from the annual report that's required by the ordinance?
Mr. Choi.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Broad, I just recently started my job in January, so I know that that provision exists towards the end of the ordinance, but I am not aware of any reporting that has been done, and if there has been, if there could have been, though, that I just not aware of.
Representative Broad.
Mr. Chair, thank you, and Mr. Troy, congratulations on your job. If you could provide the committee that annual report and any information that you learned from it, that would be very much appreciated. Thanks.
Mr. Chair, Representative, that report has been requested by our office as recent as the last week and a half, and it's still forthcoming. And as soon as our office then receives that, we will share that with the committee.
Thank you. Representative Nelson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And with the hour, I don't know how far we want to go into this, but I know that from different testifiers we heard about this strengthening communities and its relationship. We heard that this is an unfunded mandate. We heard about trust. Mr. Martinez and Mr. Choi just talked about how controversial and emotional this is, and that St. Paul is a national reputation for professionalism used as a model. Mr. Martinez brought up racial profiling. And I'm just wondering, Mr. Chairman and members and the testifiers too, especially the last two, when the state of Minnesota spent $1.9 million on a voluntary study on racial profiling, and the biggest violators that we found were the cities of Minneapolis, St. Paul, and Rochester on racial profiling, I'm having a hard time understanding how racial profiling builds trust in communities of color. I'm having a real hard time understanding while Representative Knobloch's bill actually is very permissive. It's not prescriptive. It's not mandating that reports be generated, but it allows police officers to do yet another leg of their work. And I'm wondering if these ordinances were put in place as a way to regulate and control their employees on the racial profiling report, or why those three cities pretty much blew off the report as total nonsense. And I'm not paraphrasing very much, but that's kind of how it came out. And I think that the cities would be better served putting their energy and effort in working towards those solutions rather than trying to fight a bill that is already allowed by, in fact, mandated by federal laws. I don't know if it's a question there, Mr. Chairman, or a statement, but it's something that's been niggling me for a lot more than the few months that we've been here, that racial profiling report. So.
Fair enough, Representative Nelson. Either way, we'll give Commander Martinez an opportunity to either answer the question or offer his own comment.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, Representative Nelson. That profiling bill you're talking about, one of the things that it's important to understand is only four or five cities participated in that study. We came we came forward and we're part of that. So I don't think the statistics you got was an accurate reflection. And I would argue that that our department had a disproportionate representation on the racial profiling data.
Representative Nelson.
Mr. Chairman and Mr. Martinez, just to clarify, it was 64 cities that participated voluntarily and not four or five. And the operative part is voluntary. And it did come at a cost of $1.9 million to the state of Minnesota.
Representative Lesch.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And my question was more related to, I did have two questions of the author, if it was okay. Are we ready for that, Mr. Chair?
Yep, that's fine.
But first, I'm kind of feel like a who's on first kind of argument here, because I get the sense that there's a lot of people that don't really understand the direction the ordinance was going, and then similarly and consequently the direction that the statute is going. It's sort of a ordinance saying you can't say this, and then the statute saying you can't say this, and so on and so on. And there's this cascading effect that we need to figure out. In a Boolean logic sense, what's actually going on here. But one of the most important facets of this, I think, is the discretion. It's been talked about discretion with respect to law enforcement. Who should have the discretion? Federal government makes a law. State government makes a law. City makes an ordinance. And then police departments have discretion. My first question for Representative Knobloch, if you would, was, as a prosecutor, I have some practice in experiencing police department discretion, which level the police department has discretion to do what, especially with respect to a traffic stop. So when you say that law enforcement, you do want law enforcement to have discretion in this, I believe you, but which level do you think is most appropriate to make the call with respect to immigration decisions? And just to clarify, you spoke a little bit about the chief, but then there's the commanders in St. Paul, Minneapolis has captains, and then there's the line officers that make the stops. There are sergeants and supervising folks. At which level is it most appropriate for a police officer to say this should or should not be requested as information at this particular time?
Representative Knobloch.
Well, Mr. Chairman, Representative Lesch. Firstly, I would say I don't think it's appropriate for a city to say to all of its law enforcement officials, whatever level they are at, You are not going to enforce this law. You are not going to ask questions about this particular issue. Unlike any other law we have in the country, you are not going to enforce this law. I don't think that's a good idea. As far as which particular level should have discretion, I don't think that we should have the city government forbidding any level from having any discretion at all. I think that the exact workings between the chief, the officer on the line, the commander, is something that needs to be worked out within the department. And that's why I have the language on line 20 through 25 that basically says that you can't unconditionally restrict someone from asking about immigration. In other words, you can't go ahead and just take the ordinance, if we outlaw the ordinance, and just implement it by policy. But at the same time, by saying unconditionally restrict, I also imply that there can be some restrictions. I want to leave open some discretion for the police chief if they have a line officer that's being unreasonable and is using this to harass people and only wants to ask about immigration and not do the rest of their job. I think that the police chief should have some enforcement ability over someone like that. And so I don't want to give too much power to someone at the line either. And so as far as which level we work it out, that's a policy question for the police chief and down to sort out.
Okay.
Representative Lesch, last question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'll try to compact it. That's part of the reason why I asked the question, Representative Knobloch, is because I had some experience with this, especially with respect to DWI stops, and when a person is entitled to a translator, for example. That gets litigated all the way on up with whether it's an implied consent litigation or the specific DWI litigation. So I deal with that at times, and it's a line officer, or when someone's brought down to the station, they actually have to deal with it from a sergeant about when a person is entitled to an interpreter. And then it comes back to me when the decision is appealed, and so we have to juggle, and it's frustrating. But because this is, as been discussed, a hot topic, and also because the nature of the language is such that we have a prohibition of a negative and then a prohibition of a negative on top of that, which results in, as Representative Ember would call, crafty lawyering, whatever. Maybe we should have an amendment to preclude crafty lawyering in here. But we're going to continue to deal with that as long as the law is written as such, and I think that line officers are going to continue to have to deal with this. So in light of that, my question is, we haven't heard from MPPOA at all today. I don't know. Was this a law enforcement initiative to start with?
Representative Knobloch.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Lesch, this was not an initiative that came to me from MPPOA. As my understanding, this last Friday that MPPOA had a meeting to discuss this bill and decided to take a neutral position on the bill, being neither for it or against it.
Members, with that, Chairman Knobloch, we'll turn to you for the last word before we vote.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chairman. Members, I think we've had a lot of good testimony here today. Members, again, I think that we should not have local ordinances that frustrate state and national laws. I think that we should allow our law enforcement officers to have discretion in enforcing the law. I think this gives them the tools to do so, while at the same time having in place the safeguards we need. This will enhance our national security as well. There are truly domestic terrorism concerns here that we have seen operate in the past. We should have all levels of government working together, and I hope you'll support this bill so that we can have that.
With that, members, Chairman Johnson will renew his motion that House File 2576, as amended, be recommended to pass and referred to the General Register. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed say nay.
No.
Motion prevails. The bill is recommended to the General Register. Members, we are now adjourned.